Hello there. My name is Stephen Rumford, and this is the Life and Death Podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. This is a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, bereavement, and so much more. I have worked in palliative care for more than 20 years now, and in this series I sit down with all sorts of people to discuss what life and death means to them. In this episode, I'm joined by Hayley Campbell, a journalist, writer and broadcaster whose book, All the Living and the Dead, delivers a gripping look at the professionals who have made death their life's work. Inspired by her own childhood fascination with the subject, she meets embalmers, a former death row executioner, mass fatality investigators and a bereavement midwife. She talks to gravediggers who have already dug their own graves and questions a man whose job it is to make crime scenes disappear. Hayley's book wants to change the way we think about death and remove the taboo surrounding it. A compassionate and compelling read, Hayley spent 2 years immersed in a field few people know about. Amongst the many questions raised, Hayley contemplates, would facing death directly make us fear it less? I just want to warn you that Hayley talks quite graphically about what death looks like. This includes discussions of infant death, as she talks about her experience of seeing a baby in a mortuary. It is a really important and interesting part of the conversation, but listener discretion is advised. So, Hayley, thank you very much for joining us on the Life and Death Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I got your book when it came out, and boringly, I've read quite a lot of books on death.
Dying. Me too.
Yeah, okay. Listen, we could do a kind of reading list or something, swap at the end. And, you know, I don't want to just, you know, start too sort of creepy, but I really, really, really enjoyed your book. So this was my request to have you on the podcast because I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
But I wonder if we can sort of start, not exactly at the beginning, but go back to, I suppose, the genesis of the book for you. What were the sort of driving forces that even turned your attention to these subjects?
Well, this was a tricky thing. When I was pitching the book to publishers, they were like, why death? And where did this come from? And it's always been in the back of my head. So it was really hard to find like the origin story. But I kind of naturally blame my dad because he's the first person I remember speaking to me honestly about death. And he's a comic book artist, and he was working on a book called From Hell with Alan Moore, and which is a very like graphic and brutal graphic novel about Jack the Ripper. And in order to do those pictures of these women, he had lots of like reference photos up on his drawing board of crime scenes and autopsy pictures and things that when I brought my friends over from school, they would just freak out. But I thought all dads were doing this. Like they were all, everyone's dad was at home drawing dead ladies. I had no idea until I was older and realized that some people were accountants. But the thing was, I wasn't frightened of these drawings. I just wanted to know more about them. So I would ask him questions about them. And going to a Catholic school isn't the best place to ask questions about what actually happens to dead bodies because things get really complicated around Easter and you end up annoying the priest when you're asking what color Jesus was. You know, when the stone rolled back, what color was Jesus? What happens is the priest stops talking to you. And I just carried these kind of these questions, which I think aren't weird. You know, I've had lots of interviewers go, you were a morbid kid. I think lots of kids have questions and we kind of categorize kids in a way that I'm not sure is helpful. But yeah, I had all these questions. And then when I was 13, one of my friends drowned in a flooded creek. She was trying to rescue her dog. And it was the first funeral I'd been to. And I just remember sitting in the church, and I don't really remember anything about the funeral, aside from the fact that I was in front of this white coffin, and all I could think about was, what did my friend look like inside that box? because I wanted to know basic things like, was she green? Did she look like the zombies I had seen in the movies? And you're not supposed to ask those at a funeral. And of course, I didn't. I was silent. But I became kind of conscious of the fact that there were people who knew the answers to all of these questions. Because, you know, I saw them kind of milling around the hearse. Like, there were people who had carried her coffin in. I was like, they must know. And so I've always been, from that point, I've always been interested in what happens, you know, the behind the scenes stuff, the workers who do all this stuff that is really, really important, but we don't really know exactly what it is. The body is just taken away. So when I became a journalist, I found that the best thing about being a journalist is you can completely exploit your position to just dig into things that you personally are really, really interested in. I've done it with lots of subjects, and death is the biggest one. And I found that the hardest thing was trying to get people to speak to me, because they're the people who aren't really asked about their job a lot, or they personally kind of glaze over it at dinner parties or at the school gates. They just don't, they've kind of been conditioned to not talk about it. So the fact that I went to them and was asking them questions about it, I was seen as the weird one.
So I mean, I was struck by the book that you travel quite extensively. You know, certainly there's quite a lot in the States. And even things like the sort of autopsy school, because the sort of premise of the book, I suppose, I don't know if we've fully sort of explained it, and maybe should get you to say more, but you interview various people whose job is involved with death, like, so post-mortem. They're all post-mortem workers, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I wanted to follow the body from the moment of death to being buried or burned. Because I knew it passed through a lot of people. And to figure out those jobs, I had a big cork board in my house, and I had lots of jobs. And lots of jobs didn't make it into the book. And the ones that I did choose were the people who would speak to me. And sometimes it was easier to get into the, for example, the medical school in America than it was to get into one in the UK. I'm not sure why, but there were things that were easier in the UK than it was in the US. For example, seeing an embalming would be really tricky in the US, because US funeral directors have all sorts of licenses and things, and you're not really supposed to let journalists in. And I will be honest, and I was honest in the book, embalming was the one thing I went in with a strong opinion. So I'm not, having seen a body being embalmed, it's still not something that I would want for myself, but I now understand the reasons for it. And also I learned that in a, like a disaster situation in a, you know, an airplane crash or a mass fatality disaster, like a tsunami, part of the disaster team that gets sent to that place is the embalming team. Because in order to send a body back to wherever that person is from, you have to have them embalmed. Otherwise, they can't go on the plane. That's something I didn't know.
Do you have a sort of sense of the book? Is there any progression in the book for you? You know, is it the chapter order particular, or was it when you wrote them? What was your thinking in terms of the overall shape of the book?
The chapter order is really important, I think. There is a progression. I thought it was, because you'll know about this, you've read, I don't know how many books about death, but probably the same amount as me. I could have written a book where I spent 250 pages thinking about what a dead body is like. And then at the end, I could have had that first chapter where I'm dressing a dead body for its funeral. I could have done that book, but I'm not interested in that book. I thought, you know, that's not telling me, putting out my deep thoughts is not something that I'm interested in. I wanted to have information from other people rather than just me sitting in a room quoting Shakespeare, as so many of them do. So I thought it would be interesting to start with the body, the thing that we're all supposed to be so frightened of in this, just its most basic setting. Just a funeral home, and this person hadn't died in any traumatic way. It was the most basic sort of dead body experience you could have. And I thought it would be interesting to go from one body to many And that's why the medical school came straight after that. So I go from the basic standard way most people would encounter a dead body to something that only medical students see. You know, hundreds of bodies in pieces and a shelf of severed heads and a shelf of arms and legs. And it was an interesting contrast for me. A lot of the order was, you know, it kind of formed an order in itself because it took so long for people to agree to talk to me or for me to travel to them. But then there became a sort of emotional arc with the autopsy chapter when I see the dead baby for the first time. And then it was sort of figuring that out through the next chapters. But it does have a big arc for me, which means when I see people write reviews of it and say it's a collection of essays, you can read them in any order, I go, if you do that, you're missing a huge emotional arc there, which isn't just my own. I've given the book to my family and friends to read, and I've said, you don't have to read it just because you know me, but, you know, you here it is. And they've all come back and said, well, you made me cry at this bit and this bit. But what I found interesting is that people cry in different parts, and the bits that get to people, because death is so personal, there are things that I thought was just a little detail that wasn't a sob-worthy detail, it was just a detail. That's the thing that someone will come up to me at a signing and say, oh, that bit. Mm. And there have been so many different bits. People just, it's strange what people see. It's so different to what another person sees, and they're all reading the same thing.
I mean, I was, of course, struck by the incident with the baby at the during the autopsies, and that is the, it becomes the motif that you come back to and you can't let go of. And I mean, without, is it a spoiler if we talk about that scene? I don't know. I mean, but it's the bit where you're, I think you're the person who's doing the autopsy has kind of gone off and done something, and you're stood at a kind of respectful distance. Please.
So it was the situation with the mortuary in the hospital was there was some construction of a special room off to the side, which was going to be the pediatric mortuary. But until that was completed, it was just a big room with adults and children and babies all in the same room. And when I went in, I was, you know, sent a warning letter from my friend. She said, I have to send you this because it is, you know, you're coming in to see an adult autopsy, but there's other work going on in the room, so you may see children, just in case you're, you know, worried about that. And I went in with some kind of, I didn't really think about it that much. I thought I'd seen a severed head. I'd seen a severed, you know, a body missing its head in the medical school. I thought that's pretty much as shocking as it's going to get, I think. And then when I was in the mortuary, watching the autopsy it was amazing. It was beautiful and weird. And I can't believe that all of those things make up a human and it works. But over in the corner of the room, they were, it was a forensic autopsy of a baby. So the police were there because they were trying to figure out if somebody had killed this baby. And they were taking it apart really comprehensively. And while the baby was in pieces, again, it was just science. And I was just looking at it from, you know, out of the corner of my eye, because in that room, I didn't want to, you know, get kicked out. I didn't want anyone to go, you're not supposed to be seeing this. Mm. And then there came a point when we were cleaning up after the adult autopsy, and I was kind of pushed over to that side of the room, and I saw the baby after he'd been stitched up. And he just looked like a baby, and they were washing him in this tub. And there was a moment where, you know, the anatomical pathology technologist just left him for a second as she went to go and get clothes to put him in. And he started slipping below the bubbles in this bubble bath. Just this little tub, like my mum used to wash my baby brother in. And there was something weird about this really domestic scene clashing with this mortuary autopsy scene that really got to me. Mm. And, but, you know, I think I remember speaking to somebody before when I was in the midst of writing this book, and I told him about the baby, and he said, oh, well, it obviously upsets you a lot, so you should don't write about it because you're just upsetting yourself more. And I was horrified. I said, if I don't write about it, then it's just a horrible thing that happened. It's not something that has taught me anything. It's not something I can tell people about. And it was that incident that led me to discovering Claire Beasley, the bereavement midwife. And she, I've had people say, who's your favorite person? And I can't really pick favorites, but to me, I see Claire Beasley as heroic, because I didn't know that bereavement midwives existed. And these are midwives who specialize, they work on a bereavement ward, and they specialize in delivering stillborn babies or babies who have complications so extreme they're not going to live for very long outside of the womb. And to devote your career as a midwife to that part of birth is incredible. Because nobody wants to be on the bereavement ward. And I would never know she existed unless I was about to lose a baby myself. And that is, and I thought that said so much about what I was trying to do with the book, that there are all of these people doing all of this important work, and we don't know about them or appreciate their work until our lives are falling apart and we need them. And then we'll talk to them for a bit, but then we'll kind of cast them aside again because seeing them reminds us of something traumatic while they move on to the next family and help them deal with their trauma. So I found her job completely extraordinary, and being able to go and see the ward where she does that work, and there are, you know, cupboards full of tiny, tiny coffins. It was just, you know, that took a lot out of me. But I think, finding her and talking to her about why she did her job was really helpful to me in figuring out why I was putting myself in a situation where I would see a dead baby and write about it.
I mean, you come back to it. Obviously, I said it's a motif, and it is from that point on. It's something that recurs and almost certainly get the sense as the reader that it occasionally assails you. I mean, maybe that's a device, I don't know, but it seems to kind of come to you unbidden at times, this image of the baby and what that symbolizes, without really saying what it symbolizes. And at the end, in your afterword with your time with the ex-detective, and he seems to do this thing where he almost kind of makes you put your face in it, like you've gone this far. you understand you're in now. These aren't things that you're going to lay down. Here we are having a conversation about it. There you are writing a book about it. But actually, these things are imprinted, X-ray like, you know, on your kind of on your mental retina, and you're in now. As a reader now, like aside from the point, I'm curious where that is now, this far post both writing and publishing.
Well, when I spoke to Matic, the ex-detective, he was completely right in that he told me, now it comes down to what you do with these pictures that are in your head. And I think writing the book was really useful, because I find writing things down is a way of helping me find out what I think myself. And if I had just gone to see the autopsies and I had just seen the baby and I hadn't really dug into it and gone to speak with Claire Beasley, it just would have been this floating horror in my head. But writing it down helped, and then speaking to other people about it helped. I'm sure, you know, there was about 6 months there where if you got talking to me, it would have been, you know, hello, how are you? And then the next thing I'd tell you about would be this dead baby. I'm not like that anymore, thankfully. For it was at the forefront for so long. And if I hadn't done the work of figuring out what to do with the pictures, and what Matic meant by that was make some kind of sense of it. To me, it's not just a horrific image. It was this image that led me to learning something extraordinary.
No, I had that feel, I must say. It did feel like that. You communicated that brilliantly. And also, and I'd like to go back to some of the other stories in the book. Just, we're not going to go on forever, but there's some things I would like to still. Mm-hmm. But there's something you do at the end, in the afterword, you describe why it is you think people do the type of work that you have shown throughout the book in all its forms. And you challenge the notion that there is a kind of morbidity about it, that there's some sort of morbid fascination that must underpin these people's drives to go into the work. And you suggest that it's a kind of love.
Yeah.
And that section, I think you have captured about as close as I can feel in my own life about what drove me to do palliative care, about why you do it. You know what I mean? And I look at my colleagues at work, when I look at my nursing colleagues, everyone there, in a way, that is why they do it. They don't have a morbid fascination with death. And I know that it's slightly at a different stage. We're at the dying bit. We're still with life. So, again, I'd be interested in what the kind of, you know, dying and death and what the relationship, but it's a bit abstract. But I see that love so, so often. Mm. And it is often missed. And I think you capture it really well. I had a tear. So if you want to know what my teary moment was, my tear was a bit with a baby and a gulpy moment with a baby. But my teary moment was really feeling grateful to you for capturing something that I think is really hard to communicate to lots of people who would have more of a gut, oh God, I couldn't, well, how can you do that for a job? Oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
You really got it. So I'm grateful. So thank you for that bit of writing at the end. It really moved me.
Oh, thank you.
I was curious in particular, and I know that I'm not going to take all your time, so, but just the bit in the cryo unit, mm-hmm. that, I wonder if you could say a little bit about that to the listeners.
Why? Well, I thought it would be an interesting end to this book, where I'd spoken to so many people who considered death this absolute reality, that, you know, this was going to happen to us all. I thought it might be an interesting little minor key ending to speak to people who don't think that. So I went to the Cryonics Institute in Michigan, and I know everything I know about cryonics, which TV shows and movies erroneously call cryogenics, which is something different. But everything I know about cryonics comes from Austin Powers and, you know, that Woody Allen movie Sleeper and Futurama. So I thought I went in with all of these comedy things and I thought I was going to find crazy people. And I just found more people who, they weren't that different from the people I'd been speaking to. The woman I interviewed was an embalmer in a funeral home in another time, but her job was to take the bodies in. And what they do in the Cryonics Institute is, instead of embalming a body with embalming fluid, they put in a kind of antifreeze. But it's still the same process. And then they take the bodies and they wrap them in insulation, they hang them upside down in these tanks in this big warehouse. But she saw her job, I think, you know, all of the people that I spoke to saw their job as some kind of care that they were giving people. Just because they were dead doesn't mean a person doesn't deserve care. And she saw her job as still pretty much the same as she was doing in the funeral home. She was just caring for them a bit longer, because once she embalmed these bodies with the, you know, the special antifreeze stuff, she was then looking after them for years and topping up their tanks with liquid nitrogen. So they were just hanging around a bit longer. And I thought it was going to be all like silly space age stuff. And there is another cryonics place that I think is a bit more like that in California, maybe, or Arizona. But this one was just, it was in like a really boring business park on the outskirts of a small town. You know, there was a lighting company and an insurance company and like really boring looking lawns, lots of cement. And it was just this boring looking office. And they were taking people in who thought that they could be reanimated hundreds of years from now and live again. And it was you know, I come from a comic book background, and I worked in a comic book shop for years. So I am very aware of the science fiction community and see them as kind of my people. And so, I remember sitting there talking to Hillary, and while it was all going on, there was like photos on a screen flashing by of people who had been frozen and were in the tanks just outside the door. And there were so many people who looked like Garth Marenghi, like sort of, you know, science fiction glasses, that kind of guy. I just found it really interesting. And what I found the most interesting was that none of them believed this would definitely work. Mm. They just were enthusiastic nerds who were like, well, we know what happens when we burn you or we bury you. So this is kind of an experiment. And once I found that out, I was like, oh, I don't want anyone making fun of you. That's fine. Like, that's different. I thought it was going to be more, you know, like they were trying to convert me or something on my doorstep. They really weren't. They were just like, well, it might work, it might not, but we're giving it a go. I found it really charming, actually. I still don't want it, because I think even if it does work, that would be horrible.
Yeah, it's a different kind of horror, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, never mind the fact that you might be 98 still. So they're going to have to have kind of solved sentience as well as death. Like, there's so many problems that they've got. Problems,
so many,
inverted commas, you know.
It's all just putting our hopes in these brainy future people.
Yeah. But we do it all the time, don't we? I mean, climate change is a perfect example of the current one. You know, we believe in some way that there is an answer. Science will provide it. There is this problem, the fact that we're completely and utterly ruining the one planet we've got.
And continuing to do so.
And continue to do so. So can we continue to do so and fix it at the same time? Yes, you can. Come along. You know, you can see the brochure, can't you? I did. I really love that. So in terms of you and the effect of the book, I want to ask something like, has it done what you thought it would do? Like, has it changed your understanding of what death is? Or that might not be the right question, but has it changed your perceptions of mortality? And has it changed anything about you in terms of how you feel about yourself as someone now living and will be dead?
Well, I feel a lot more fragile. That's for one thing.
Okay.
I have stopped reading books about death. I used to read them all, and now I don't want them in my house, because there is nothing that I can get out of a book from somebody who hasn't gone to see it that I don't know. You know, I feel like I know more than them now. There was one interview I did that didn't make it in. I went to speak to a philosopher called Brian McGee.
Oh, yeah, no, Brian. He's old school.
Very old school. But he spent his whole life writing about his fear of death. And I thought, you know, he was 89 when I went to speak to him in a nursing home in Oxford. And for some reason, he agreed to meet with me, whereas I know lots of other people who have asked for interviews with him, and he said no. So... my pitch must have been okay to his agent. But I went to speak to him about his fear of death, and he was telling me about how now that he was approaching the end, he didn't really fear death at all. And he put it down to the fact that your fear of death is highest when you have the most to lose and you are most in love with life. And he, at 89, didn't really have much. He was confined to one room. He couldn't walk anymore. And when I went to visit him, he had his books spread out in front of him. He was doing like an audit on his own life. And he had thought about death to the point where he realized it was coming, and he gave himself enough time to say goodbye to himself. And I really liked that. But when I was talking to him about my book, I said, have you... This fear of death, did it help when you saw a dead body? And he said, oh, I've never seen a dead body.
Wow.
So even still with a man who had come so close, like he thought about it so much more than most, there was still this fear of the dead body. And I did have it in the book for a while, but it just didn't fit with what I was doing. But I still think it's completely fascinating that death for some people is still a kind of theoretical thing that you can write books about and you can read books about, but it's still other. You still don't want to see the physicality of it. And having now seen the physicality of it, I can't bear the books talking about the theory of it. You know, it probably makes me sound quite snobby now, but maybe I'll come back to them. But right now I'm kind of allergic.
Fair enough. I can imagine that you're going to do a sort of K-pop book or something totally...
I'll write a book about flowers.
Totally other. Yeah, just totally about life. Spring. It's going to be called Spring, my next book, and it's got it all about life.
Yeah, I was deep in it. I feel like I can't just go half back in now, so...
I suppose I'm curious about your experience. You've gone through it. You say you feel more... what was the word? Not tender. You
fragile.
Fragile, thank you. Yeah. More fragile. As a result of doing... a service by glaring so kind of in such an open-eyed fashion on so many aspects of the dead, not the dying, not the ill, but the dead, the remains. Do you think we should be addressing notions that we are death denying, and how would we best do that as a society, do you think?
I do. Well, it comes back, I think what I've done is useful to me. Personally, from the very basic point of view that when my family die, I know that my sister is going to fall apart. So I feel like I've put my oxygen mask on first.
Okay.
In order to deal with that, just on a basic practical level. But it comes back to this story about I told about my friend drowning when I was 13, and all of these horrific images I had in my mind from pictures I'd seen on my dad's drawing board and on the news and video games and stuff. Because if you're not given information, if death is being denied around you, if people aren't answering your questions or treating you as strange if you ask them, you're going to just fill that blank area with information you do have, which is fictional and horrific. And I don't think helped me when Harriet drowned. I don't. It certainly. I do wonder if, you know, if I had seen her body, if I would have grown up to write this book. And the funeral director I spoke to, who invited me to help dress a dead man for his funeral, when I saw her giving a talk, she said she wished she could bring children into her mortuary so that they could see death before they had to give them a chance to come to terms with the physicality of what a dead body looks like and how it's not as frightening as we think they are. Mm. Just so that when you are confronted with your own mother's death, you're not processing what a dead body likes at the same time as you're processing your loss. So I find it really useful to now know everything that's going on behind the scenes. It doesn't mean I don't fear death. It just means that there's part of it that I'm okay with.
Mm-hmm. I think I'd just end it by saying again, thank you. I think you have written a really, really significant, important book. You've done it clearly in your own style. There is no real sentimentality in there, which always pleases me enormously when it comes to these books. It's clear-eyed, it's honest, and it's particularly well written. Oh. And I really, really enjoyed it, and I'd recommend it to anyone who had any interest in this subject.
Thank you very much. It's so lovely to be interviewed by someone who's read it.
I'd show you all my turned down covers, but I would be getting indulgent, so I'm going to say thank you, and you've been brilliant.
Okay, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Life and Death podcast. Hayley's book, All the Living and the Dead, is available to purchase now from wherever you buy your books. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where there is an array of resources to support people who are experiencing grief and bereavement. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do let us know. Send us a message on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just search Ashgate Hospice. You've been listening to the Life and Death Podcast. I've been your host, Stephen Rumford. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.